And welcome to the first episode of, or the second episode of the Kevin Magnussen Appreciation Corner podcast.
Oh God!
Hello to everyone who listens to us here at DRS Open Podcast, and hello, Wame, my friend. How are you?
I'm alive, Langa. How are you?
No, I'm great. I'm great. Did you watch some Formula One this weekend?
Of course I did. And you can gloat. I know. I had a terrible day at the office. I get that. You can start now.
No. Okay. I can't even dive straight into it. But what a weekend, right? I mean, it was quite unusual. Like in South Africa, pre-practice one was at like 4 p.m., which is really cool because I finished work and yeah, and I could like watch it. Well, you know, watch it without feeling guilty for not concentrating on my work, you know.
Are you admitting that you do miss work sometimes for Formula One? This is a very public podcast, sir.
I don't miss work. I respond to stuff, but I have the benefit. I'm very lucky. I've got more than one screen, and I also have television. So the Formula One can play in the background whilst I work, allegedly.
Sure, we can all go with that, I guess.
Yeah, listen, like you said, this is a public platform. But, you know, 4 o'clock Friday, I'd already knocked off and got to watch some practicing on a circuit that, you know, a lot of people are very skeptical about, that had a couple of changes. Certain corners were widened, you know, the corner where Max threw his car into the wall at quali last year was made wider. Hint, hint, FIA agenda.
To be honest, it kind of does seem like it was made wider for him, because how many times he tried to make contact with this past session. I'm just saying, wink, wink.
Yeah, it was crazy. Like, one of the things about street circuits is just how narrow they are, and it's really scary at Jeddah watching those guys absolutely floor it at like millimeters away from the wall. Like I said to you last week, one of the things that I'm really enjoying about, or want to enjoy this season, is just watching skilled people have their chance to do what they do at their best. And I think even two races into this weekend, we've seen that. Although, I don't know if you followed the practice sessions, so many cars have so many issues, particularly around reliability.
I think this past weekend showed us that not every car is where we thought it was. I think more than anything, we saw that every car or every team has issues, and it's different issues, it's not the same issue. I think the one issue that all teams kind of struggle with, especially Ferrari and Mercedes, is the poor pressing. But other than that, there's just different issues everywhere. Mercedes has more than one issue at the moment, but we'll come back up stronger. I just believe in my team, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, you're right when you also say it's not just the porpoising, although every team is suffering from that to more or less a degree. Like Red Bull powertrains, because we're going to move away from calling it Honda, bless them, look like it's very, very shaky. Obviously, we had three DNFs last week in Bahrain, and this week Yuki Tsunoda didn't even start the race, which is really disappointing because it looked like they had some potential there. So those are like just two examples of how different and how varying everyone's problems are, whether it's a Mercedes power unit, whether it's a Ferrari power unit, whether it's the Red Bull powertrains or Honda power unit. It's some teams are looking very shady in the light.
Yeah, and shaky, I think the top teams, it's both actually. I think the top teams are the ones that kind of have, not a grip, but like they kind of have a bit of solutions to their problems. But then you look at not the sister teams, you look at the engine supplier teams. Like, for example, Alfa Romeo has a Ferrari engine, but it also has like two retirements so far. And then you look at the Honda powered engines, and Yuki didn't even start. And then you look at the Mercedes engines, but the Mercedes engines have reliability. That's one thing that I've noticed. It's just that Latifi is just a terrible driver. I don't know why he's in an F1 car, so we can't really blame him. And then you have Albon also. Like, Mercedes powered engines have a bit of reliability more than the Honda powered ones and the Ferrari ones.
I think so too. But also, can we just like pause for a moment and consider that Nicholas Latifi threw his car on the wall 3 times in one weekend? He crashed in practice, he crashed in quali, he crashed in the main race. I mean, is anyone on the grid having a worse time of it than him right now? I can't imagine.
I keep saying, get that man out of Formula One. Like, no, like, even this track exposed him. Like you said at the beginning of this episode, you said that track was just a track that shows how skilled the drivers are. And to be honest, it just exposed Latifi for the fraud that he is. Not that anyone was racing Latifi on these top 10, but I'm sorry, but get Latifi out of Formula One, guys. Like, I can't do this. And it's like, Latifi always knows when to throw his car, like when to throw his car into the wall to serve a Red Bull car. It's always them. It's always Red Bull benefiting from Latifi's crashes. Always their team. And I saw conspiracies online this past weekend, and I believe every single one of them. People said that Latifi is hired by Red Bull. And you know what? I think that's the truth, because there's no way he's in a Formula One car and he does that. I feel like I can do a much better job than Latifi. And I don't even have a super license.
Listen, I can't. I genuinely can't fight it. I think last year, especially around the middle of the season, I remember thinking to myself, you know, obviously, he was being outqualified by George Russell every weekend in the Williams, but he had some really decent race pace. And obviously they were fighting at the back of the field, but there were a lot of races where, you know, maybe George Russell would outqualify him by 5 or 6 places, and he'd come up and finish really close to George Russell in the race. So I thought to myself, you know what? He's not spectacular. He's never going to be a world champion or anything like that, but he seems solid enough. I don't know what's happened since Abu Dhabi. I mean, that's if Abu Dhabi was actually 2 races ago, right? I can't, you know, Bahrain and this weekend. I mean, 3 times in a weekend. I think that is quite possibly the worst overall weekend performance I have ever seen from any driver in my life.
You know what? That's why I keep saying that it's kind of brave to call him a driver, Formula One driver. Like, he's a salary thief, and I just need him out of F1. Because what is that? Like, I feel like Latifi's driving, or lack of driving, is a danger to just the drivers as well. Because his crash is always, like, on track. Like, he never goes through into, like, the wall that's further from the track. Like, he's always, like, very near the track, you know, very near those corners. And it's very dangerous. Like, he can, like, I don't know what to say. Oh my God, I just need that man out of Formula One. And it's not even an agenda. I think we can all agree collectively that Latifi just doesn't belong in an F1 car, because you can't have a weekend as terrible as he did. You can't throw your car into the wall every session. Oh my God, no. No, there's a problem there. I'm sorry. Like, there's a problem there, and we need it sorted.
I think it's funny, like, you're just springing a thought to my mind, because there are lots of ways to ruin a weekend. And I know we're going to jumping through things a little bit, but it was, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 laps maybe into the race, where Fernando Alonso and Esteban Ocon, who are allegedly teammates, decide that they're going to have a battle for the ages. And the team principal is just sitting back and is just like, let them race. I mean, let them race for what? Valtteri Bottas couldn't believe his luck right behind these guys, because, like, Latifi showed an individual sort of lack of competence, right? But the collective, the collective incompetence at Alpine defies belief. How do you let your racers do that, potentially crash, and also then sacrifice their race in terms of ruining both their driver's tires and letting the guys that you're actually racing, the opposite team, catch up with you? It's insane.
And they did it for, I think, 5 to 6 laps. And we're all just watching, like, what is happening here? And they were also aggressive at it. There was a time when Alonso was so aggressive. No, Ocon started being very aggressive. And then Alonso brought it back. He was just like, you know what? If you want to take it there, I will take it there. And he took it there. And it was just like a bizarre, it was just a bizarre wheel to wheel, because we're just like, who are they fighting? Like, why are they fighting? Why are they fighting? Like, why are they, what are they exactly trying to do? I was actually so entertained. And then when Alonso's car just started, like, when his car started having reliability issues, I'm just like, yes! Like, agenda aside, I don't know what you guys are trying to do, trying to race each other, but then you know, as well as everyone knows, that your car isn't the best when it comes to reliability. So I don't know what he was trying to do. Like, that was just actually so bizarre.
It's so weird for me, because last year, you know, Fernando Alonso, obviously the famous or infamous defense that he pulled off against Hamilton in Hungary, you know, is what allowed Esteban Ocon to win the race. And, you know, Esteban Ocon sort of returned the favor was it Qatar, where Alonso was on the podium? Qatar. So, like, I thought that these are two guys who, at least from an observational perspective, seem to get along, and they absolutely went hammer and tongs against each other. A couple of times I thought to myself, they're going to crash. And I thought literally after like maybe two corners that the team principal would get involved. And like you said, it went on for 5, 6, 7 laps, which is incredible. I've never seen, well, and I have, you know, maybe seen something like that. Yeah.
It reminded me of Mercedes 2016. Like, I was just like, is this Mercedes 2.0, but like with the Alpines now? Like, it was just, it gave, for me, I was thinking, ah, man, that's a mid off. Like, I can't believe these two drivers are trying to fight it out like this in a car like that. Like, please be serious. And how Bottas was like at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, again, he only was there because they lost so much time battling each other. Like, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'm just a really conservative person. Maybe this is why I'm not a racer. But like, if I was Esteban Ocon, I would have probably at some stage just said, okay, Grootman, okay, Chopra, you know, go through. It is what it is. But they didn't allow it. And, you know, they've got to figure themselves out, because they clearly have a decent car. Where was Alonso running before his retirement? You know, they were looking on for some good points. Esteban Ocon, you know, finished 6th. So another really strong performance by him in that regard. So they've got a decent car in them. But if they're going to allow that sort of stupidity to happen, they're going to end up dropping a lot more points than they need to. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
I think it's early into the season, so they don't want to let team orders play right now, because I don't know who's ahead, but they just feel like maybe the gap isn't that big, so they're just going to let them out, let them race on track. But there's certain seconds where you can do that, and there's certain instances where you can do that, and I don't think Jeddah was the perfect time to do that. Like, I just feel like that was just terrible. It was a terrible call from Otmar. And you know what? I did ask what was Otmar going to do at Alpine, but everyone was just saying that he's done wonders at Racing Point. And I'm like, yeah, but what did he do at Aston Martin? And why do we think that he's still going to do something wonderful at Alpine? And look at his first judgment call. Like, when he needed his leadership, he wasn't there. He just said, let's let them race. Race what?
Exactly. I mean, you're quite right. Like, the thing about team orders is that it's not about preferring one driver over the other, you know, 90% of the time. Sometimes it's just common sense. It's just common sense that you just don't want your drivers to crash. So you told them to hold position and to not race each other. It's not about preferring one driver. It's just about saying, okay, well, the guy ahead is ahead. We don't want the guy who's behind to try and overtake, especially with this DRS, this new DRS dynamic, which I'm sure we're going to get to. But, you know, there was a nice segue about Otmar Szafnauer and what he did at Aston Martin, because whatever is happening at Aston Martin does not look good. And last week we spoke about how Vettel is probably going to leave this place. He's probably going to leave the sport, at least in my estimation, at the end of the year. He won't be encouraged again
I actually.
Aston Martin, the last of the cars that actually finished the race. Yeah.
I actually have three drivers that I think are not going to come back to Formula One next year. And Latifi obviously is one of them. Vettel is also one of them. And I think Ricciardo as well is going to be one of them. I just have a feeling about that.
Yeah, because his problems are many. Daniel Ricciardo, he reminds me a little bit of Fernando Alonso. A lot of a big criticism of Alonso's career is that he's made the wrong moves at the wrong time in his career. That's been a very constant criticism. And if you look at Daniel Ricciardo leaving Red Bull when he did for Renault. Right, it's the same Renault that was providing terrible power units to Red Bull. So what did he see there? He takes 2 seasons. He starts to look like he's improving a little bit towards the end of his second year at Renault. I think he got a podium, and there was that whole bet with his team principal at the time, Cyril Abiteboul. And then he moves to McLaren, which looked a little bit sideways, but you could kind of see why he would make that decision. Given that McLaren looked like they had an upward trajectory, but he's just really, really struggling. Again, another DNF for him. It was just terrible, especially because his teammate put in a strong performance, I think, by Lando Norris to finish P7. I don't know what you think, given your Norris agenda. Do you have an agenda against Norris?
Yes, fully. It's very. But before we get to like Norris, I just feel like is it too early to start speaking to start the conversation about these new regulations? I feel like I did mention this last week that they kind of are a flop, and then they also kind of are working in a way like we get closer racing, of course, but other than that, there's just so many engine reliability issues that we've seen from different teams. And then you've just seen how that like it's a mess really. Like we don't know which team is on top. Like of course we can say like Ferrari and Red Bull are like on top because they seem to have a bit of like the issue sorted out. But in the like judging from how they started in Bahrain where they had zero issues, getting to Jeddah as a Jeddah, yes, they got into Jeddah and we saw the issues as well. So it's just like, are these regulations working or are these regulations a flop?
I think that's a good question. I think if the regulations were supposed to do one thing, it was to bring the field together. That's not necessarily obvious yet, but it was to also allow for closer wheel-to-wheel racing, and we're definitely getting that. Last year, and in fact, the whole of the turbo hybrid era, essentially, once a car, was overtaken, especially under DRS, it was almost always the end of the battle. And I'm sure we'll get onto it a little bit later, but Leclerc and Verstappen especially have shown us in this first two races that there are tricks to be played now, given how closely you can follow the car in front of you and the triggering of DRS. I think Formula One might want to consider DRS now. And whether it is still serving its purpose, or maybe trying to find some sort of innovative solutions to DRS. I don't know. Maybe I'm just thinking out loud. For example, you can only use DRS once in a lap, or just moving the I don't know what they actually call the line in this technical perspective, but I'm just going to call it the trigger point for where DRS can be opened. Maybe moving that further back from the actual corner at a circuit like Jeddah. So it's working from that perspective. I think on the engine side, look, the sport does have to move towards, for example, more sustainable energy, more sustainable fuels. And this E10 fuel that they've got now that some powertrains seem to be struggling to get on top of, is the move in the right direction. The sport has to go there. So I think you have to regulate it. And they'll figure it out eventually. Remember, we're still at a very early stage of this new development cycle. And yeah, I appreciate the point that you're making that, well, maybe it's not working because all these cars are so unreliable. But I think the other side of that coin would be to say, well, certain engineers and powertrains need to figure it out.
Okay, fair. We can shelve this conversation for like much later into the season. But also speaking of like world tour racing, I think the battle between, oh my God, I can't even believe I'm going to say this, but the battle between the Haas and the Mercedes was also a bit like fascinating and interesting to watch, because it was also just like DRS after DRS. It was also a battle of like, it was not mind games. I hate the word, I hate that phrase, mind games. But I think it was more of like experience and how they were both baiting each other to overtake. And then they knew that the next zone was a DRS zone, so they would take back that position then. But it was also a very nice battle to watch between Kevin Magnussen and Lewis Hamilton, which is a very bizarre thing to say ever. I hope Mercedes knows what the, like, knows how much pain they've caused me. Like, I'm even puking on the inside just saying this. I can't believe I'm saying Haas and the Mercedes were battling it out. Like, I never want to sit through that ever again.
Well, I said at the beginning that this is the Kevin Magnussen Appreciation Corner podcast. What a driver he is. And I'm saying this, like, sincerely with no, like, baiting. I might have said it last week when he left the sport. You know, a lot of people were really, really sad because we know how fast he can be, and he's a driver who's coming into his prime, and he's put in two worldly performances in his first two races back, and he's making his teammate look a little bit shady in the light.
Is it okay to start the conversation?
I mean, we might as well. We're talking about Haas and you know, but okay, well, let me wrap up this appreciation corner. You know, like exactly what you're saying, Wamed, Hamilton and Magnussen put on a wonderful display. They drove really, really smart. And, you know, it's actually this whole thing about this toying with the DRS zone is actually quite interesting, because it's not entirely a new thing. I just think, again, because the cars can follow so closely, that it's become more prevalent. After all, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but like after Jeddah last year and Max's brake testing or whatever, what was fundamentally at play there was that you also had two drivers who were trying to make sure that they are not ahead at the DRS detection zone. I mean, that is exactly what started it. So again, maybe Formula One needs to think about DRS detection zones and how to police that. But yeah, it was brilliant. But yes, Mick Schumacher, terrible.
Like you said at the beginning of this episode, you said that Jeddah was just a track that shows how skilled drivers are, and the less skilled drivers, the ones who are there via nepotism, you know, came out, like they crashed. And we saw that, you know, it was just like, oh, but I can't actually say this because the Ferrari boys also kind of threw it into the wall. But that was just a different, and that's a different conversation, because there's no race weekend where the Ferrari boys don't just throw it into the wall. Like, I've, like, ever since last year, those two always know when to just crash. But, this is a conversation about Mick Schumacher. I mean, guys, let's be honest. Like, let's just be honest. Let's just shame the devil and just be honest. Is Mick, like, you know, a racing driver? Like, does he have what it takes to be on that grid, given the competition against him? I mean, Kevin is putting that car into, like, the points, but, like, he's, like, putting it into the top 10. And Mick is still there chilling, you know, with the back markers, you know. And I'm just like, okay, Mick.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, obviously, he didn't race this weekend, right? But I get what you're saying, because the reason he didn't race is because he lost his car. It's not as if, you know, he fell ill or something like that. I think, listen, he did win. He is an F2 champion. And I think people, and I don't know this myself, but people who I've spoken to about Schumacher's career have always said that he tends to start slowly and builds up. He's not ever been someone who gets into a car and is on the limit from the get-go. So I do think he will, if that trend is still true, then maybe he will have a still decent Formula One career. I think he deserved the shot, again, by virtue of being an F2 champion. But I do agree with you that, particularly amongst his age group, his peers, You can't imagine him ending up being a world champion. Whether or not is that the, but is the question is that the gold standard for driving in Formula One? I don't know. I mean, when I look at the current grid, there are a lot of former world champions on the current grid, of course, but especially with the guys sort of coming in, we've spoken about Latifi, we've got Lance Stroll on the grid, and so Guan Yu, perhaps, I don't know. Like, I don't think any of those guys, to me, scream future world champion. Alex Albon is another one, absolutely. So none of them say future world champion. So if they're there, you're going to get, some people really believe in Gasly. I agree with you, but, you know, some people might have an opinion about that. So the question then becomes, you know, is Mick Schumacher, he's not out of touch with that group. And if they're all in Formula One, then he probably does deserve to be there.
I mean, I guess I hear your argument, but no. It's just, I feel like with Mick, people are making the same argument as they made with Ricciardo, where they said he needs to get used to the car and everything like that. But we have to remember that Kevin was called to race in Bahrain. And that was the second testing when Mick had much more experience and time with the car. So I get what you're saying, that he needs to gradually get into the season, and then he starts showing off towards like the second half of the season. But nope, no ways. I'm not convinced, and I'm never going to be convinced. In terms of the Gasly thing, guys, Gasly is consistent, and I think I can give him that. Sure, that I can give him. He's very, very consistent, but he bottles it under pressure. And we can even go back to this weekend where when Lewis passed him, he did not defend his position. It's just like how Lando is. Like whenever Lewis is behind Lando, Lando just moves away from him. There's no defending, and it's the same with Gasly. But Lando might be championship material, but I'm not convinced yet. But he kind of has a running chance. And when it comes to Gasly, he just doesn't. He was introduced into a big team. He couldn't take the pressure, was demoted into a sister team, and he's just been consistent, of course. But that consistency isn't mind-blowing. You can't just sit there and be like, oh, wow, no, I want to see him at Mercedes. Which I've seen tweets where people say they want to see him at Mercedes, and I'm like, what's he going to do there? Like, what exactly is he going to do there? He couldn't even do it at Red Bull.
I agree with you, and I love the way that you framed it, because I actually have the same thing, which is like a wow factor. And, you know, we're going to get to the Ferraris, I'm sure. And, you know, I know that this is going to sound contradictory to like a lot of like my tweets and stuff, but I have a very strong Carlos Sainz agenda. I really, really believe in him. And I still believe that he may have better race pace than Charles Leclerc. But what Carlos Sainz doesn't have is exactly what you're talking about, that wow factor. He doesn't have that that lap, that quali lap, or something that just makes you think to yourself, how on earth has he been able to do that? And I always think that's going to put you at a disadvantage in the Sainz example against Leclerc, because Leclerc is very good at controlling races from the front. And, you know, if he keeps getting out qualified by this driver who can whip out magic over one lap, then he's going to struggle, Carlos Sainz, even if he might have slightly better race pace. But again, to your general point, again, I fully agree. I think Lando does have that. I mean, you think about last year, his lap, that final run in Austria, where everyone was just like, what on earth has just happened in the final lap? He's had moments of brilliance in qualifying. He's had moments of brilliance in the race defensively. So he definitely has it. Whether he's got the full package together, I don't know. But I do think, again, dragging that car to P7 was overall a strong performance, because the McLaren, certainly in quali and practice, did not look like it was a car that was going to finish with a strong haul of points.
You know what Science reminds me of, or who Science reminds me of? He reminds me of Bottas. Like, he's the perfect number two in a way. Like, Sainz also doesn't scream championship material. Like, he just screams number two. And he's that consistent. Like, he can win Ferrari the constructors, but I don't see him actually fighting for the drivers, because you look at his pace as well. Okay, you said it's an agenda or whatever, that you think he's faster than Leclerc, which I don't believe, but I feel like I've seen this before. I've seen this dynamic before, where there's Charles and then there's a Sainz. You know, it's like a Hamilton and a Bottas thing. No doubt that Bottas is good, and no doubt that Sainz is also good, but they're up against people with the wow factor. You understand? Like, they're up against people who are very talented, and they don't have that thing. You know, I looked at Sainz this past weekend and how he was easily passed by Max, and I was just like, how did that even happen? And yeah, So yeah, I'm just, you know, like, Sainz is a perfect number two, but I don't see him as like a championship material. I really just don't. And yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it's the wow factor, and maybe he doesn't have it, even though he will continue to score lots of points, particularly, you know, if Leclerc doesn't, we don't know. Leclerc looks like the type of driver now who looks like he can win a world championship. It's only two races, so maybe I'm getting way too far ahead of myself. But yeah, Sainz is gonna struggle there. He's gonna struggle there, no doubt. But someone who's not struggling, and we started that little section by talking about Mick Schumacher and how he struggled to get on the pace, but someone who's not struggling to do that is George Russell. Another really strong performance by him. Quietly goes about his business. I think he qualified P6 and finished the race fifth on the road. What more can we say about this very clearly talented young man?
Can I just admit, and I love the way you laughed when you said that, can I just admit that my George Russell agenda might just get dropped? Not yet, but it might just get dropped, because he had two solid performances the past two races, and I'm pretty impressed by him. And yeah, like, he's just really talented, and we can see that he can, like, given the right car, Mercedes F1 AMG Petronas team, I'm looking at you, given the right car, he can actually do something amazing with it. But we will see. He's still on fraud watch, but I might just drop my agenda.
I love how you're just like, yeah, okay, I see you, but not really. You know, and I think that's what you're saying. Once he's got the machinery, then it becomes a question of, you know, how far can he take it? Because we know that Toto believes in him, has believed in him, and all of Mercedes has believed in him for a very, very long time. But we can't talk about Russell without talking about Hamilton. And I know you're not going to want to go here, but we have to take it there. Saturday night.
Why are we speaking about Quali when we speak about Lewis? We've spoken about every other driver, not mentioned Quali. But now you want to mention Lewis's Quali performance. What is wrong with you? No, like, genuinely, what's your problem?
I'm just trying to understand and get a sincere opinion about what do you think went wrong. If anyone hasn't listened, Hamilton qualified 16th, I think.
There was no need to mention that. Everyone could have looked it up, okay? But from what I've heard from Mercedes is that Lewis, his engineers tried a different setup to, like, George Russell's car, which failed dismally, and just the car had no grip. We saw during Q1 that he was just sliding all over track. The car had no grip. Ooh, I said drip. The car had no grip. The car had no pace. Like, he did try to improve, but he was just not improving his times, and it was just a terrible day. But you look at his race, he had a really solid race, and, like, he was pushing on those hard tires. He really was pushing on those hard tires. And he was P6 until someone at Mercedes, I don't want to mention his name, someone at Mercedes decided that, you know what, we are just not going to pit him at the right time. And just, you know, vibe along and just let vibes, just let vibes rule our race. But yeah, Lewis did drive his heart out there. I'm not going to lie. Like, that was a solid performance from him. And I'm genuinely proud of him given the machinery that he has right now. But also, disclaimer, I would never just not be proud of Lewis. I'm always proud of that man.
Yeah. I mean, again, Kevin Magnussen appreciation corner here. Like, he made light, Hamilton made light work of everyone except for K-Mag, right? So, like, K-Mag, in terms of his run through the field, was the one major obstacle where you thought to yourself, okay, could get into trouble. It was a really interesting tactic. So, of course, not of course, Hamilton was the only, well, one of very few drivers who started on the hard tires. And obviously, that was always going to be really difficult to get up to temperature. And I think it was even after five or six laps where he was saying he has absolutely no grip. But after that, when the tires started to come to him and they started to come to temperature, he started to put on the type of masterclass that we know him for. I think there is, I think some of us might have forgotten. Okay, let me speak for myself. I had forgotten how challenging it is to overtake at Saudi. And, you know, he made it look a lot easier than it is. And the thing this year, again, I've just got to recalibrate my brain, is that Mercedes doesn't have the speed differential. DRS helps, of course, but the Mercedes doesn't actually have the speed differential on all the cars now. So overtaking in a Mercedes is a lot more difficult than it would be right now in a Ferrari or a Red Bull. And you know, you've got to give props to the man. I mean, that stint was 39, maybe 40 laps. I'm not sure what happened with the communication. Well, I know what I saw, but you know, it's still open up to interpretation about what happened with his pit lane entry at the with the virtual safety car. I am open to the argument that he saw the car at the pit lane entry and hesitated for safety reasons, or just thinking that he might get a penalty if he enters the pit lane dangerously, although his pit wall had told him that the car was there, right? So they had told him that the car was there and he must watch out for it. But I am empathetic to the idea that maybe upon seeing the car, even if he was anticipating it, that he, you know, decided to stay out. And that, unfortunately, closed the opportunity for him to get a cheap pit stop under a virtual safety car and potentially finish slightly higher up the road. If that had gone well, he might have ended up finishing P7, P8,
P6, I think. P6.
No, but he would have pitted, but I think he would have still come out behind a couple of the guys. But yeah, again, we're debating over granular detail. The point is he had to drop back and then do some more overtaking, which he did, and you know, managed to bring the car home P10. Really good performance, but it's just a sign of how troubled Mercedes are. And what do you make of the fact that they clearly implemented different setups on the car, between George Russell and Hamilton?
I feel like they were trying to get like maximum power out of both cars. And of course, trying different setups, which is something that they've always done. Like if you listen to like podcasts or like interviews from like last season, different seasons and everything, you know that Bottas and Lewis used to work on each other's setups, and Lewis would like recommend a setup for Bottas that would work, you know, and Bottas would recommend a setup for Lewis that would work. So I think it was just that thing where they were trying two different setups to see which one would actually work, because judging from also what they were saying, they wanted to go into like the race thinking that they can also start at the pits. You know, they start at the pit lane where they would change everything. But clearly they saw something that we didn't see, because it did work out. That strategy did work out for them until like the 40th lap. But they were actually just, I don't know. Yeah. You know, Mercedes just makes me very mad, and it also breaks my heart, and then it also gives me hope. There's just so much that's going on there. I'm sorry, like I can't even form like an opinion or just come up with something without getting heartbroken. I'm just so sorry. I can't, like, I just need my team to get it together, because I'm not used to this. Yesterday I was celebrating P10 because I just felt like, okay, fine, we're in the points, And then I looked at myself in the mirror and I'm like, when did we become these people? Like, Mercedes will pay. I'm sorry, Mercedes will pay. Once they get back up there, because I have no doubt that they will get back up there, I need them to apply pressure. And when they get back up there, I need my team to also work on their pit stops. I need my team to also work on the strategies, because they have the perfect strategy sometimes. But then when the safety car comes, or like all these other, you know, delays in the race come, yellow flags comes out, they just forget what they had and they don't change anything. Oh my God. Oh my God. No. Like, yo, no. I can't.
Yeah. One of the really interesting things that I heard was that I don't know what they had done with the setup, but there was the idea that in quali, his rear axle was completely like unstable. But there, and you're right, so they were thinking about pretty much dismantling the car, putting it back together, taking the requisite penalties and starting from the pit lane. But I think someone figured out within the Mercedes team that the rear instability would be sorted out simply by the fact that there was a full load of fuel in the car. You know, obviously in quali, you're running very, very low fuels because you want to go as fast as possible. And obviously race, you've got your minimum fuel that you have to put in. So that would make sense. And it is unfortunate. There's stuff to be done. And I will say, I've said this to you before, like, you know, as fun as last year was, you know, having two guys slug it out for a championship, some of my favorite years have been like where my team or my driver is like absolutely nowhere. Cause then I just watch the sport and appreciate it. And just enjoy it for free. Like, I don't know. Use it, don't use it.
Yeah, that's not gonna happen with us. You'll take those back. That's not gonna happen with us. Anyways, moving along from Lewis, because you enjoy seeing me heartbroken. Let's talk about the battle at the front. Or are we talking about Checo and Sainz first, or the battle at the front? I think the battle at the front is the
first. First of all, I don't enjoy seeing you heartbroken. I don't. But it is quite funny watching like the collective Mercedes meltdown because honestly, guys, 8 years of utter dominance. Like, yeah, it had to end sometime. But yeah, listen,
It's not yet ended. I just need to correct you there. It's not yet ended. It's not ending. We'll be back up.
You sound so much like McLaren fans in 2012. And there was actually a tweet that I found where McLaren F1, I think it was in 2012 or 2013, and they said there's still potential in the car. I found that tweet. I've bookmarked it. I'm going to release it later in the season. But anyway, let's not talk about that. You said I was picking on Hamilton and qualifying. Checo Perez, like, just last week, we were suggesting that maybe Checo doesn't have like the quali pace and that sort of stuff. And then he pulls a worldie. Like, honestly, guys, I can't remember even a Max Verstappen pole that made me feel as ecstatic as I felt this last weekend. Honestly, and I think I said it maybe on Sunday, like, I know that there are no points for Saturdays, but if you cannot enjoy moments like that and laps like that, then what is the point? What even is the point? I was buzzing as if he had won a world championship. Like, Checo Perez, take a bow, sir. And then the race happened. And he was doing so well. But anyway.
Latifi again. Latifi is hired by Red Bull to work for Max and Max only. If your name is not Max Verstappen, Latifi doesn't crash to benefit you. And that's what I'm going to say on this Checo case. And that's it. But then we move to the front. And I mean, everyone else can say they enjoyed that battle. To be honest, I didn't care about it. Like, I was just worried about Lewis and like what was happening with Mercedes, because I even watched an onboard. Like, I just felt like, you know what, the front runners can do whatever they want to do. I'm just worried about the Mercedes, and that's what I'm going to watch. But, and then I did watch it though. Like, I just stopped doing what I was doing, and then I watched the front runners. And Charles Leclerc is a really, really good F1 driver, guys. I think we need to say that. And Max was trying to win on complaints. I don't know who told him that he can be a steward now, but he was just trying to win on complaints. And I've never seen that. Like, he was complaining throughout the race. I'm like, get a grip, race. Michael Masi is not here. You're going to have to race now and stop relying on complaining and everything. Like, he spent so much time with Horner that he's become Horner. I can't believe it. Like, this is actually so, I don't know. Like, it's just, it's funny to watch. It's just funny to witness. But that was actually a really good battle at the front. I'm not going to lie. It really was.
Wow. So after all that, it's just like, yeah, it was a good battle. You know, shout out to Ferrari. I tweeted during this last week that I owe Matteo Binotto a big, big apology. I was one of the people in 2019 who was just like, this guy absolutely has to go as team principal. And all he has done is put his head down, put the right people in the right positions at Ferrari. Last year, he wasn't even attending races. I think he attended less than five. You know, it was that he was always back at Maranello, you know, helping and working with the teams and just focusing on also where he can add value as an engineer. We know that, you know, he was involved with, I think, the F2004. And one of the brilliant things, and you know, we talked about Checo briefly and how unlucky he was in the race that the safety car came out at the wrong time. But equally, it was a Ferrari bluff that threw him into the pits. You know, some people are saying, well, if he had stayed out, then Leclerc would have come in because Leclerc was in his undercut range. That was the key, so he couldn't quite pull away from Leclerc. He was always in the like 2.1 to 2.5 seconds ahead of Leclerc, but that was still within the undercut range. And, you know, that ultimately for Ferrari gained them a podium, a double podium, which they probably wouldn't otherwise have got. And at least an extra 3 points in the Constructors' Championship. And that's going to be vital. Like, the turnaround at Ferrari, given how many clownish decisions they've made, particularly from a pit wall perspective and strategy in the last 3 to 4 years, has been phenomenal. And I just felt like I needed to say that out there. Like, I was one of the biggest haters. But right now, again, it's only two races, but it's been two pretty close to perfect performances from the guys from Maranello.
I am saying this on a public platform, that Ferrari is not as good as everyone thinks it is. And I will take this back if I'm proven wrong at the end of the season. But I'm saying those people aren't scaring me. And like, they just aren't scaring me, you know. Once my team sorts out its issues, we are going to see everyone else flop. You know what we used to speak about, you and I used last season, is that you can have the pace and you can have the team and everything, but you need to have the entire package. And that's what Mercedes kind of has. You know how Lewis comes back, second half of the season, Lewis comes back always stronger. And like, he's like a beast at the second half of the season that we don't know where he gets all this energy and everything else. And then that's when Max started to fumble last season. That's when he started to act out of character, not out of character. That was his character, to be honest. But that's when we saw him act out, and the pressure was actually getting to him. So I don't think Ferrari can actually also do anything under pressure. I think they will crumble under pressure. But if they prove me wrong, I will take back my words. I'm still maintaining them right now, though, that I don't think they have what it takes, but we will see.
Sure. And yeah, I mean, again, it's only two races to be talking about world championships. I know that I'm guilty of it, so maybe I'm, you know, should look in the mirror first, but it is way too early to be talking about the world championship. And I also think, you know, again, but I want to give them their props for what they've done operationally. But what I will say is that after two races, and also two races are two very different kinds of circuits, it's pretty clear to me that the Red Bull has the race pace on Ferrari. The problem is that Leclerc and the Ferrari seem to have that little bit extra. And one thing that Max is really, really, really struggling with at the moment is his tire prep. He's even, you know, trying so many things. If you watch the practice sessions, in terms of trying to get his quali simulations right, and he's not nailing it. I think these new tires, he hasn't quite got to grips with the new tires. But we see in the race, when they come up to temperature, the Red Bull is faster than Ferrari. But that makes also for a fascinating dynamic, because half of the time, by the point at which the Red Bulls come up to temperature and they start to show their performance, Ferrari's, you know, maybe a couple of seconds up the field. And just by the way, that's another point, just a side note, we were talking about the regulations and how they're working. No one's run away up the field so far. Like, I don't remember Leclerc, because I mean, he's led most of the last two races, at any point leading by like more than 5 seconds. So I think I do think the regulations are working, for what it's worth. But I get what you're saying about Ferrari. They are inexperienced, and I'm not sure they've got the fastest race pace car. But, you know, if they keep operating at a high level and picking up those extra points, anything's possible for them this year, especially in the Constructors' Championship, I think.
Anything can happen. It's just, well, just two races in. And, yeah, like, I also wanted to bring that up earlier about how, like, we've gotten closer racing, like, there hasn't been a time delta of like more than 5 seconds. Like, we haven't reached like your 10 seconds and 30 seconds. Oh my god, 30 seconds used to trigger me. Like, it still does trigger me, because that was Austria 2021. Oh my god, what a terrible race. But yeah, I think in terms of like closer racing, the regulations are actually nailing that. But we need to look at all of them and not just like the closer racing one that they wanted, which I know is the biggest one that they were aiming for. But there's other minuscule, the other minuscule things that we need to look at. But all in all, this race weekend was very eventful. We can't forget the missile attack that we saw, and how F1 just decided that they're just going to put everyone's lives at risk, the team personnel, the drivers, the team principals, the fans. You know, like, it was already a hostile situation where everyone around Jeddah was also affected by this, like, the people, the residents living there were affected by these missile attacks. But F1 just didn't care about that. They didn't care about the people there. They didn't care about the drivers there. They just cared about the money. And what we saw was just sports watching on a whole different level. And that was just, I don't know, I don't have any words for that. But besides that, yesterday's race also gave us like really great racing, and it was a bit enjoyable, well, for everyone besides Mercedes fans, but it was a bit enjoyable, and I really just can't wait to see more races and the three-way battle.
Yeah, it's really interesting. My sister's not really into the sport, but, you know, she's always watching with us and stuff like that. And she made the observation yesterday that me and my family and a few friends that we were watching together with, we were on our feet standing for 40 out of the 50 laps. Apparently, most of the time that we sat was when there was a safety car, which was a sign of just how exhilarating the race was. It was so memorable in a beautiful way. And, you know, like I was saying last week, it's so nice to be excited and talking about stuff that's happening on the track right through the grid. And like you said, the missile strikes that were happening were really, really scary. And the sport really showed us, you know, how far they're prepared to go, you know, for cash. Because like you're saying, it's one thing to think about the circuit and the people who are at the circuit, you know, but so little is, let me try find the right words, but there's not enough that was spoken about people who would have been affected by this, you know, native Saudi people who would have been deeply affected by what happened. And for the race to happen in that sort of backdrop, it leaves a sad taste in the mouth. I think I tweeted this earlier this weekend as well. I loved the race, but please never misunderstand me when I say that, no, this weekend should probably not have happened, all things considered. But, you know, once it did happen, you know, the product was phenomenal, under the lights, you know, for quali and for the race. It's the best and worst of the sport. It's the best and worst of society and what it says about us collectively.
Yeah, like sometimes Formula One makes it so hard to enjoy it. Like when you look at the politics out of it, not the racing aspect of it, it makes it so hard to like enjoy, because you just see that it's a corporation more than it is. Like it's just a corporation and it will do what it needs to do to get that bag, and there's not much the fans or anyone else can do, not even the drivers. For the first time, I think in a long time, the drivers saw how powerless they were. Like they even had a meeting for, I think, 5 hours where they're trying to sort out everything and trying to like come up with a solution for all of that, because they just didn't feel safe. And everyone was just like, nope, no cuties, it's not gonna happen to you guys. I'm very sorry. Like, you guys are just here to do your jobs, and I'm gonna need you guys to actually do your jobs. Which is pretty disheartening. But yeah, what can we say? It's a corporation, and we can't actually, there's not much we can say, guys. Like, we should also know our limits. Not our limits, but we should also know, like, our power can only do so much, you know. It was a pretty disappointing stance from the FIA.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, before we go, I have one question. I'm interested in your opinion about, I don't know how to frame it, this whole DRS thing and this idea that drivers are trying to, what can I call it, outslow each other into the DRS detection. So, I mean, if you saw, I think it was the second time that Max went against Leclerc, you know, they slowed right down to the point that Max locked up. And then obviously only when Leclerc noticed that Max locked up, he knew that he would have a few tenths on him, and you know, he shot off up the road. What do you think of that, like, as a dynamic that's developing in the sport now under these new regulations?
I think you brought up earlier, like, your argument was actually, it's the one that actually got me thinking. I think Formula One has to rethink the whole DRS thing. Side note, guys, whenever I hear DRS, like, watching a race, and then I hear, like, something about DRS, I get so excited because I'm like, oh, is it our podcast being mentioned? Like, relax, mommy. But, yeah, I just think it's something that we need to actually look at again and just rethink it, because I think we have closer racing now, and like the purpose of DRS was to get like closer racing and easier overtaking, and I think these new regulations have given us that. So like you said, maybe like for one lap, like, we should have a limit as to how many times in a lap someone can use DRS, or like how many times, like how many DRS zones we have. Maybe we should have like only one DRS zone, you know, or just do away with the whole concept. But I don't know how everyone would be without DRS. I just don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still figuring it out. And, you know, I mean, DRS was only introduced, was it at the beginning of the turbo hybrid era, or was it just before? No, I think it was 2014 or so, or 15 maybe. So it's a relatively, in terms of the history of Formula One, it's a relatively new concept. And once we're at a place where cars don't need it, because, you know, like you said, it was introduced because there was no overtaking, because the cars are so big, they're so cumbersome, they threw so much dirty air, it was impossible to follow. So this was, you know, an artificial sort of development on the cars to allow them to overtake and to create the spectacle. And like you said, we need to reassess, the sports needs to reassess whether that's still necessary. I do think it's still probably necessary right now, but we probably should start making some tweaks to it, whatever those tweaks are. I don't know. But what I there's something very counterintuitive and weird for me about watching two guys trying to slow down more than each other so that Yeah, it just it was a weird, it was a weird image for me. But yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah, you're right. Anyways, guys, see you next week. I hope, no, see you in 2 weeks' time, actually. I hope I'll come back much happier than Langa, and I would just prove him wrong in everything that I've said tonight or like in the past 2 weeks. But yeah, I just hope I come back with a happier and like a much better Mercedes happier fan, if that makes any sense, you know.
Yeah, I think 2 weeks is a long time in motorsport. Australia is far, so I don't know how quickly the freight and stuff can. I mean, I don't think that actually matters. 2 weeks is a long time. They've got some very smart people in that garage. They will start to make strides. They just need to get on top of that porpoising, and they need to figure that out more than anything else. And they'll be fine. They'll be fine. But you best believe I'm going to enjoy this for as long as it lasts.
Sure, that sounds just like jealousy. I mean, your team couldn't actually do anything about your team. listen, your team couldn't do anything about how we were winning, and now you guys are enjoying quote unquote a downfall just two races in. Oh my God, I need you guys to be actually serious about this.
We'll see. Albert Park, we haven't raced there in a couple of years. It's got lots of corners, high downforce. I think Ferrari are going to be very, very difficult to beat there. I think they might even want to that race. But once we get to Europe and sort of the faster circuits like Silverstone, for example, I think Red Bull will start to come into their own. But we'll see. And I will speak to you in about 2 weeks' time.
Okay, cheers. Bye, guys. See you on our next episode.
Ciao.